This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Yana Byers, and I'm here today with Rod Phillips, professor of history at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada, to talk about his book, French Wine, out in 2016 with the University of California Press and just published in paperback in 2020. Hi, Rod. How are you?
Yana, hi. Nice to be here. Good to see you.
Wonderful. I am so happy to have you here. So how's Canada this morning?
My bit of Canada in Ottawa is sunny. It's cool. I'm looking at 16 degrees. It's, you know, we've had everything from 35 in the last few weeks, 35 degrees to 11 degrees during the day. So it's everything. It's what you expect in the spring.
Sure. Absolutely. I imagine it is, beautiful and, well, you know, Canada. So I always imagine there are like moose and whatnot running around, but probably not in your part.
Not outside my window.
No, probably not. All right. So listeners, Rod started his career studying the history of the family, specifically divorce, publishing Family Breakdown in late 18th century France, Divorces in Rouen, 1792 to 1802, Clarendon Press in 1980, Divorce in New Zealand, Oxford 81, Putting Asunder, A History of Divorce in Western Society, Cambridge 88, and Untying the Knot, Divorce in Western Society, Cambridge 91. So that's a lot of divorce. Also, a lot of books rather quickly, I want to say, as an historian. It's an impressive list. And then we see this pivot to wine with The Short History of Wine, Penguin 2000, Ontario Wine Country, Whitecap 2006, Alcohol, A History, UNC Press 2014, 9,000 Years of Wine, A World History, Whitecap 2017, The Wines of Canada, Absolutely Unexpected, Infinite Ideas 2017, and Wine, A Social and Cultural History of the Drink That Changed Our Lives, Infinite Ideas 2018. Rod, that's a lot of books. You have been a busy, busy scholar.
Yes, and but I mean, there was a long dry period, if I can call it a dry period, between 2000, I think, and about 2014.
All right.
Nothing much there, and that was because I became a wine columnist for the local newspaper in Ottawa. and all of a sudden I was inundated with invitations to go here and there, like come to South Africa, come to Bulgaria, come to Burgundy and so on, so on, so on, and taste the wines. And so for about 10 years, I traveled and tasted and wrote about wine as a wine columnist. I didn't do any history. And then around 2012, I suddenly realized I was missing history. And that's why I started back and I started with the history of alcohol, since I've been teaching that course for quite a long time. And then the other stuff followed. And there's then a few more in the works. Yeah.
Yeah, I see. I mean, I see a kind of natural progression from divorce to wine, but that does explain kind of this break. That sounds like a good problem to have, traveling around, drinking wine and talking about it.
It was a really fabulous time. And I got to see parts of the world I wouldn't normally have gotten to very easily. So no, it was a fabulous time.
Yeah, that sounds great. But I understand missing history. She's the queen of the disciplines. And So I think it's interesting, right, that you have this book about New Zealand. So you go to France, which makes sense both on a wine level and then also that you are, a French historian. But then you also have this book about New Zealand. So it seems like wine is the deal here, right? It's about the wine, not the place so much.
The book on New Zealand is about divorce.
Oh, didn't you? Oh, right. Okay.
It's about divorce. Yeah.
Oh, my mistake.
No, I'm New Zealand at my birth. And I went to Europe to do my PhD, and then I went back to New Zealand to teach for about 7 years. And it's very, New Zealand is still a long way from anywhere, and especially France. And so since I was working on divorce in France, I figured, well, I'll write a history of divorce in New Zealand. So I kind of did that as a filler in a way.
Right.
Okay. That's where that comes from.
All right. So actually, yeah. And I just read these titles aloud, so you'd think they would stick in my head for more than a minute. Yeah. Also I do prep for these things, despite how you may not also see that happening, but no, it's the wines of Canada, right? So we see that you end up writing about Canada, which is unexpected on a number of levels. I mean, first of all, and I, no prejudice intended, but like, I don't often think of Canada and wine going together, just climactically.
Right.
But also it's, I'm guessing that is about you being living in Canada for so long.
Yeah, living in Canada. And because, for the last 20 years, I've been writing about wine, writing about modern wine, not just the history of wine. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm familiar with Canadian wine regions and wineries and wine people. And then Infinite Ideas publishes this series called The Classic Wine Library, which has been going for decades and decades and decades under various publishers. And they asked if I would write their volume on wine. So they mean they've got dozens of volumes on various regions, as well as on styles like port and sherry and so on. And I'm doing another one for them as soon as I can get back to France. I'm doing another one on the wines of Southwest France for them. It's a region I especially like.
All right. And so I want to stress that this book, despite you having worked as a wine journalist, not despite, I see it coming together because I know you worked as a wine journalist and this is a very readable book. And it's clearly not just for specialists, right? This is not a book for historians alone. Yeah. What was the kind of your scope, the aim of the book? Who did you want to talk to?
Well, I wanted to talk to specialists, but I also wanted it to be accessible to people who are interested in wine. I mean, there's a very large, wine constituency out there. And I'm not just thinking of people who just go and buy wine and drink wine, but there are people who are interested in wine. And, they read, fairly serious wine magazines that are not just about, 10 cheap and cheerful wines from Chile, something like that. They want to know more about production and producers and the history of things and that kind of thing. So it's quite a decent audience. So I wanted to bring them in as well. And then I thought, it also has, possible market with students, like students of food and drink. A lot of courses now, colleges, universities, offering courses in the history of food and drink. So it can play into that as well. So sure. I mean, publishers hate this, of course, when you say, everybody will want to read this book. And I mean, they hear that from just about every author pitching a book, right? Saying, "Oh, this is everyone's going to buy this book." But so that's what I aimed for, and I don't know. I I meet academics and I meet just wine people who I'm not just going to say they've read the book, but they bought the book. And so it's sort of, you know, I think it's sort of worked.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. It's also a very serious book of history, though. This is a good, solid, an historian will not be disappointed with this purchase. It is a very serious book. Economic, social, and cultural history kind of blended together with this broad variety of sources. And I'm curious about what you particularly liked best about the historian's craft here. Like, what was your favorite source, or what did you enjoy working on?
Well, in this book, and it's the same with the big book on divorce I did, I've really combined a lot of secondary sources, because it's a kind of synthetic, any survey is a synthetic work. I mean, you don't do primary work on every period in every place. So it's very synthetic. And so a lot of secondary books, articles, and things like that. Then a lot of primary printed material, you know, going back to the 1500s, you know, up to the 1900s, I suppose. And then some primary material. I mean, I've been working in French archives for years and years, and especially on wine, because I got some more projects coming up. So I blend as much of that in as I can. So, you know, it's really a blend of sources, and from, you know, various parts of France. As for, you know, I found some of the early works on agriculture to be really, really interesting. You know, published around 1600. I mean, they're, you know, huge tomes, really encyclopedic. And it's very difficult not to keep on reading. I mean, you go for the viticulture bit, and then you see, oh, now there's something on rye. What do they got to say about rye? And, you know, so it's easy to be distracted. But I mean, really, really fascinating approaches to agriculture and raising interesting questions. Yeah, lots of good material.
Lots of good material. Also, there's some great images in the book. They're really wonderful. Right. Yeah.
I think, go on.
No.
Oh, I was going to say, I think most of them, I have most of the images myself. I think I supplied them to the press, because I've been collecting printed image material. I think there's a set of stamps in there or something like that, you know, things like that. So yeah, no, it's great. I would have liked to have had it in color, of course, but everyone would like color images in their books.
Right. Yeah, everyone except budgeting editors, apparently, like managing editors and budget departments.
Right.
They are impossible to deal with. So you open this book with the assertion that France is perceived to be even celebrated and revered as the producer of the best wines in the world. And, you know, on some level, there are amongst a certain crowd to suggest anything else is almost heretical.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and this has been the case for almost 200 years. Why is this? What is it about French wine? Why do we love it so much?
It's a very interesting, it's a great question, which I honestly had difficulty answering. I mean, when I grew up, I got interested in wine when I was a teenager. And it was very clear. I was actually buying volumes from this classic wine library that I've now written for. I was buying them in 1963, some of my earliest books are in that series. And they're mostly, you know, it's like Bordeaux. It's all about Bordeaux, sometimes Burgundy. And Champagne gets a look in. And then occasionally you get a bit of German Riesling called Rhine Riesling or Hock, something like that. No one ever mentions Italy. Spain gets a mention for sherry. Portugal gets a mention for port. But it's all France, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a couple of regions. And people are fixated on that, but they still are. I mean, if you look at Wine Spectator and all these things, you know, you get your annual vintage report on Bordeaux. Right, and everyone just goes crazy. You know, what's it going to sell for? Which are the best producers this year, and so on. I mean, it's a weird kind of fixation, but there it is. It's historically quite deep, and I mean, there's no question when I started getting interested in wine that French wine was the best wine. No, hands down, not even a question. And then I think, you know, what's really interesting is, you know, from the 1990s, you get California. some Australia, South Africa, a bit of New Zealand, from South Africa, South America, maybe. And gradually, and Italy began to pull things together, and Spain as well. And then all of a sudden, you know, France was the best, still the best, but now there were other stuff coming up, you know, behind it. And now, I mean, I love French wine. I'm a real Francophile when it comes to wine. But there's fabulous wine from so many places now. Right? I just would never say French wine is the best wine, because it's so much not good French wine.
Yeah, especially if you're on the shelves in America, right? The North America gets some really depressing French wine. But if you're, and you can be in any random grocery store in the smallest town in the middle of nowhere in France, and there's exceptional wine all around you, and it costs nothing.
There's so much of it, I go to France about four times a year. I've been in Burgundy pretty consistently for the last two or three years. But, you know, you go, yeah, I mean, there's so much stuff you've never seen before, right? And I love doing that. I find a bottle, I have no idea what it is, what the who the producer is. That for me is that's pleasure, just to open it up. And not always pleasure when you drink it, but I mean, you know, you never know what you're going to find. It's just an adventure the whole time. But what I wanted to do in the book was, because I'm also very skeptical about, I mean, as a historian, you know, you're skeptical about traditions and reputations and that kind of thing. Since we know that so many of these traditions, not really traditions, and so many reputations are undeserved. And I wanted to sort of correct the record a bit when it came to French wine, and just to be a little hard-headed about you know, how things were done. Because you have, you know, now, if you, you know, you buy a French bottle of wine from France, I mean, not always, but occasionally you see something on the back label that says, we make this in the traditional way. Well, first of all, that doesn't mean anything, because what's tradition? But secondly, traditional? I mean, when you look at winemaking in the 18th century, nobody would drink that stuff now, right? I mean, they crushed the grapes, put them into a vat, and just left them. Didn't do anything, left them for months. And then they, you know, racked it into or siphoned it off into barrels and left it there for a bit and then sold it. The stuff was probably disgusting.
Sure.
So making wine in the so-called traditional way, I think, don't say that, because I'm not buying it then. The whole idea that, you know, this family's been making wine for 10 generations, or our vines were first planted in 1346, doesn't mean anything. You go to South Africa and they tell you they've got the oldest soils in the world, and you think, and?
That's great.
Your soils are 5 billion years older than somebody else's.
But you know, we have this idea that old is better, right? Like, it's venerable then.
Yeah, we do. And so I just want to sort of puncture some of those balloons. And I mean, I'm very skeptical about the notion of terroir, which I've written about elsewhere. And so I wanted to sort of talk about the way terroir developed and why. I mean, it's purely marketing. And, the reputation of Bordeaux wines through the classified cru, the cru system, how that was developed. I mean, this is not new information, but it seemed to be new to a lot of people. The wines weren't judged on quality. They were simply judged on, on price, you know. So the most expensive wine was the best wine. I wanted to sort of be hard-headed about this and not be romantic, because there's so many wine books are just about the romance of wine and how amazing wine is and how amazing the countryside is and how amazing the vignerons are and that kind of thing. And you think, well, no, probably not.
As a rule, right, this stuff everyone knows, it's something like, I think there's something about an historian who wants desperately to just get in there and say, like, well, actually, you don't know. So there's that. Yeah. There's also that thing about the French, right? It's also like French food. We have they've somehow managed to convince us that French food and French technique is the queen of all the techniques, and yeah, that's all we should do. That said, I really love French food. They're not, it is delicious.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. But it's regional and which is great. I mean, it's not just true of France, it's true of lots of places. But regionality, right? I mean, the regionality of the wines, the regionality of the food and everything else is really very attractive. You don't have to drive very far. I mean, you only have to drive 50 kilometers, 100 kilometers, and you're somewhere where the cheese is totally different, mm-hmm, and the wine is different and that kind of thing. I spent 10 days in Bourget, which hardly anyone, I don't think it's even in the book, but I mean, it's a region I personally discovered a couple of years ago, and it's just east of Burgundy, east of Beaujolais, and northwest of Lyon, and it's a little wine region. It's a tiny wine region. They've got 70 producers or something like that, but it's an AOC, right? It's an appellation, and so I spent 10 days there. And I just wrote an article on it. It's a fabulous place, right? But I discovered so many. Well, they have different wine, grape varieties I'd never tasted before. Then they've got sausages I'd never tasted before, and some cheeses that were new. And it was, I felt the sense that I think a lot of wine writers feel when they write about the romance of the wine and the romance of the region, because I got there and no one really knows about it. I mean, it's hardly ever written about. It's just a forgotten appellation. And they were so happy to see somebody.
Right.
They were so happy to see a wine writer, right? I contacted the Association of Vignerons and said, I want to come and write an article. I'm in Canada. I want to come and write an article. Could you set up an itinerary for me between these dates? And I didn't know if anyone was going to take me up on this. And 2 days later, they said, well, here's the beginnings of your itinerary. And it was packed, packed. And then they were saying, could you do another one like at 8 p.m.? You know, because... I was up at 7 in the morning. I didn't get back to my place until about 10 at night. And it was taste. And these were the nicest people in the world. I mean, the first place I'd get to at 7:30, they would have coffee and croissant and everything ready for me. And then somebody would take me to lunch or make lunch in their kitchen. And then I'd have dinner and taste, giving me wine. I mean, they'd say, can I give you some wine? I say, no, it's fine. No. You have to have at least one bottle, two bottles. I end up with 74 bottles of wine.
Oh, my God. What did you even do? Yeah, the logistics of that baffle me.
I have a friend who lives not far from there, so I just left it. I left it with her. I said, you can drink these ones, but keep these ones till I get back. I haven't got back yet after the pandemic began. But the nicest people, and I was seduced by this place. You know, it was quite unlike any place I'd been to. These were just, and I hate the word authentic, but these were just like such nice people, down to earth, hardworking, decent, friendly, do anything for you kinds of people. Fabulous. In these tiny villages of like 30 people.
Wow.
One winemaker, you know, one producer.
So I feel like maybe you still do have a little romance, for a little French romance there going on.
I was surprised, to be honest. I didn't know what to do. And I wrote the article for a wine magazine. And I went through a couple of drafts because I kept sliding off into this kind of, these are the most best people in the world or the best wines in the world. I kept drifting off and thinking, I gotta keep my feet on the ground.
That's delightful. I'm going to look for that piece. So I want to talk about the history of this a bit. Let's take us back in time. So as an historian, I really like to think about and stress the unifying characteristics that make up the Mediterranean culture, right? The things around that the people in the sea, both north and south sides, really have in common. And I was thinking when I was reading this, how much wine is a product of the Mediterranean world, right? And it really connects France with that tradition.
Right. Yes, it is, isn't it? I mean, the first vines were planted by Greeks and then by Romans, and it started on the Mediterranean coast or just in the town of Lat was key and so on, and then moved in following the rivers, obviously, which are the easiest way to travel, well, not always the easiest way, but I mean the certainly the best way to move wine. So yeah, following the rivers, so along the Garonne and Gironde up to Bordeaux, and then up the Rhone from the Mediterranean up the River Rhone and so on. So yeah, very much Mediterranean to start with, but it really wasn't long before they were planting in northern France. And in places that don't, you're not going to, well, I mean, you might, with global warming, I mean, climate change, the northern frontier of viticulture is moving steadily northwards. But I mean, I got, sources, 18th century sources that have, wine being made in Normandy. Mm-hmm. I lived in Normandy for a year, and I can tell you there's no wine being made there. At that time, anyway, maybe now, good cider, but not wine.
Well, I mean, how much of that move north has to do with Christianity? What's the role of Christianity there?
I think I'm a bit ambivalent about it. It's, I mean, the initial push is with the Romans, who not only created a military empire but an economic empire as well. So that they would move in there. Their merchants would get land, plant vines, and so on. So, I mean, what they wanted to do was recreate Italy in terms of food and drink, right? So they needed wine. So they planted wine. But then Christianity is obviously a very big influence as well, because the Christians embraced wine. I mean, it's wine is the most commonly mentioned beverage, and the grapevine is the most commonly mentioned plant in the Bible, and then wine just became central to the rituals through the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. In the early Middle Ages, there were regulations set down by a number of church councils saying that every archbishop, every cathedral must have a vineyard, must produce their own vines, because they need the sacramental wine, and so the easiest thing is to grow it yourself and make it yourself and so on. And then of course the religious houses, the monks and nuns began to produce wine as well as beer. So Christianity is important. What I'm not sure of, and when you get to the Middle Ages and people talk about the importance of monasteries for wine, and you'll find it said that the church was the biggest producer of wine and that kind of, I don't know if that's true, and I think partly monastic records are better kept than private records. I mean, they have a continuity over time, and they were also record keepers, whereas individuals who planted vineyards and might have had them in the family for a couple of generations and then they died out, we have no records of those. So I think there's church records are privileged and are better conserved. And where you do get some records, as you do in England, and aren't that many vineyards, but monastic, and this is before the Reformation, monastic vineyards were, I think, only about 25-30% of all the vineyards. Now, we don't know how big they were. It's quite possible that they were bigger, and therefore they didn't make just 25% of the wine. They might have made 50% of the wine. I don't know. But I think you just have to be a bit careful about the importance of the church, recognizing that it's important, but without suggesting that it had this kind of dominance that that it appeared to have.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And you can also see, even by the early Middle Ages, that there's this very clear management of vineyard and wine production in the secular world as well. And that was one of the things I was really impressed by, that we have viticulture very early.
Right. And that's another thing. I mean, the monks were very careful because they were harvesting God's bounty and they were looking after God's wealth. And so they wrote everything down. We're doing this with the vines, and we're using mulch here, and we're pruning them in this way. And everyone says, well, the monks invented all this stuff, or they were the pioneers in doing this. But we don't know. I mean, maybe the monks are looking over the fence, at a secular vineyard and saying, oh, that looks like a good way of doing it, and they wrote it down. I mean, so we don't know, right? I mean, the record is. I just say it's an open question. I don't want to diminish the role of the church by any means, but I think you've got to be realistic about the sources that you're using and how they may bias the information that you have.
Yeah, very important. Okay, so Romans take over Europe and around the Mediterranean and try to turn it into Italy, which they do, and then Europeans go and take over colonize all over the globe and do their best to turn that into Europe in a lot of ways, right? They take their pigs, they take their horses, and they take their vineyards.
Right.
So we see the new world then becomes this spot for wine production. And in some ways, there are people who would tell you that's where all the best wines are now.
Yes, there are people who would say that.
And you certainly can't, you can't turn around without seeing a Chilean wine or a South African wine these days, right?
Right. Well, it's very interesting, really, because, the big wine imperialists are the Spanish. Because, they're the ones who, they colonized the Americas first. They try to plant vines in Mexico, but the climate is not good. But they all down the west coast of South America, from Peru, Ecuador, all the way down the coast of Chile, and then over in over the Andes in Argentina. I mean, they have a big wine industry it's within a couple of decades of actually colonizing Mexico. It's incredibly fast. I mean, they're racing down with the army. They've got the soldiers. They've got missionaries who are familiar with growing vines. They pick out the best locations for vines, which are still some of the best locations for vines, and they plant them in the 1550s, 1560s. It's astonishing. So that's what they want to do. They want to keep a supply of wine. I mean, and people say, well, of course, it's for the church, it's for Eucharist, but you don't need that much for Eucharist.
No.
most of it's pretty secular wine. And they have so much that they then have a brandy industry because they can't consume all the wine they're making, so they distill it into brandy. So then they have a big brandy industry and a pisco industry and so on. So the Spanish are like that. Now, the funny thing is, The English are kind of iffy about wine. I mean, they try to grow grapes in Virginia and a few other places, but then they discover that tobacco did better. So scrap the wine. Let's we'll grow tobacco, And it, you know, the colonists didn't really do well with wine at all until kind of the early, really the 19th century, late 1830, 19th century, the English colonists. And then South Africa, the Dutch, but that's, they wanted to be able to kind of refuel their ships sailing from the Netherlands to the East Indies via the Cape. And it was, the Cape was sort of halfway, and they wanted to be able to take on fresh supplies of wine because it had health properties. And so that's why they started there. And Australia and New Zealand were very late in the early 19th century and the mid-19th century. The big country missing it here is France. And this is what really struck me after doing, you know, writing the stuff on colonialism, saying, why aren't the French planting grapes anywhere in their colonies? I mean, you could say, well, the colonies aren't suitable, like Quebec or Louisiana or, the Caribbean colonies. You could say they're not suitable, but everyone else was trying to grow grapes where in places that weren't suitable. I mean, they tried and then gave up. The French didn't even try. And I think this is really, I think it's really fascinating and something I'd like to do a bit more on, because I just wonder if there's any discussion in the French government at this time, people saying, well, we should plant vines, and other people saying, no, we shouldn't for these reasons. But there's just they're not interested.
And that's irony.
It is, isn't it? Eh? Yeah. And you think, well, maybe the French wine lobby was so strong, they just didn't want the competition. I mean, the Spanish wine lobby tried to halt the planting of vines in the New World, because when they saw the New World opening up, they thought, wow, you know, I've got a huge new market now for our wines. And well, no. And I wonder if the French wine lobby, but it's hard to think of a wine lobby at that time, you know, but, mm-hmm.
But yeah, vignerons travel, like French vignerons go into the New World, right?
Right. Yeah, the vignerons travel, and mean the English use French vignerons to write the manuals. I mean, how to grow grapes in Virginia. They get some guy who'd grown grapes in Languedoc, who had never been to Virginia, had no idea what local conditions were like, but was saying, oh, no, it's easy. This is how you do it. So vignerons had the... and the same in South Africa, but the vignerons travel, but the French had no colonial policy or imperial policy along those lines.
That is very interesting.
It is interesting, yeah. And you can only think, well, they just didn't want the competition for the domestic women. That's all I could think of.
Sure. Yeah. I want you to do more work on that. I want to read about that. Yeah. Think about that for me. Another thing I'm reading about this, and I'm here for the wine. I'm a wine lover. Obviously. But there's this point, you know, wine is just a beverage. Wine is food. Wine is something that you drink, you know, you drink to keep yourself alive in the winter, maybe even. But at some point, it's also this luxury and a pleasure. And it becomes a sign of distinction, you know, to have a good wine collection. How does this happen? When is there a point when this happens?
Well, I think it does become a product of conspicuous consumption, you know, in the way that, you know, you might have a swan. You know, a roasted swan on your table, you would want, you know, wine from a particular region. And, you know, there are, and I mentioned them in the book, you know, there are records of cellars of nobles and their cellars and the buyers, the king's wine buyers going into various regions to buy wine and everything. And they clearly, you know, they're looking for particular kinds of wine, I mean, from particular places. I've got a book coming out on Volnay, the village in Burgundy, coming out next year. And they mentioned that, you know, the king's buyers and the queen's buyers coming in, and you know, one will buy 600 barrels and one will buy 200 barrels. But you know, they know what they're looking for. So you know, it's all about reputation and prestige and that kind of thing. Now, you know, quite how it functioned, I don't know. And it's not easy to know how deep that kind of thing is. I mean, you know, what kinds of people have cellars? Obviously, you have to have disposable money and so on. And these are real cellars, right? I mean, you got to have a real cellar. But I don't know. I'm just starting a book on wine and the French Revolution, and I've done a bit of preliminary research, and during the Revolution, the government ordered the confiscation of the wine cellars, the fine wines of counter-revolutionaries. And they said the wines would be put to the use of the nation. And it was never quite clear what that meant, whether they were going to sort of sell them, you know, sort of and sell them just and then, you know, get the cash or what. But they were. They confiscated these cellars, and you have, you know, lists of barrels and bottles and so on that they've confiscated. But it's not clear where it went. So that's something for me to look at. Mm-hmm. I know there was a case in Beaune in Burgundy of somebody complained that one of the local officials was actually drinking the stuff. I mean, confiscating it and then taking it home. But so I don't know what happened to that. But you can sort of get a sense of who has a cellar, at least, because some of these counter-revolutionaries are not nobles. They're well, some of them are priests, mm-hmm. Some of them are bourgeois, and so on. So I'm going to sort of follow that trail and try to figure out what kinds of people. I mean, they've got to be counter-revolutionaries, but you know, what kinds of people, what kinds of occupations and so on might have a wine cellar.
Yeah, that's an interesting, and that's a point where you can tell a lot about someone by that, right? I mean, but also wine like manages to escape the bad rap that some other alcohol gets. You know, there's a déclassé kind of thing towards beer and being a beer drinker. Gin is credited with basically destroying the English working class. Right. Rum leads to piracy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But wine doesn't seem to have any really terrible effects either. Wine is this kind of cherished drink.
Well, I think it is because, first of all, it has this religious connotation. Mm-hmm. I mean, how bad can it be if Jesus turned water into wine, right? Mm-hmm.
Sure.
I mean, that's a real problem. Yes. It's a real problem in the 19th century for the prohibitionists, so the Christian prohibitionists. I mean, they have to do a workaround there. So it has a religious thing. It has a health connotation. I mean, wine is seen to be a healthy beverage. Nothing specific, but just, you know, drinking wine keeps you healthy, good for digestion, and so on. I mean, some of the medical books actually specify, like in the medieval, early modern period, will specify that, you know, for this kind of problem, you should drink this kind of wine, you know, sort of a light white wine or a heavier dark wine. But mostly it's considered to be healthy. And I mean, right through the 19th century, right into the 20th century, you know, the physicians are still talking about the health benefits of wine. And it doesn't disappear until 20s, 30s. I mean, after Prohibition, and then it came back with the French paradox, mm-hmm. in the 1990s. That you know, this idea that, you know, wine was what kept the French from having high rates of coronary disease. So I think that plays into it, but also the fact that it's a kind of middle class. It's a middle class drink, you know. I mean, wealthy people drink wine, poor people don't. And so, you know, if you're looking for harmful things, it's what poor people do, mm-hmm. and not what wealthy people do. You know, and the whole idea that, you know, poor people go into pubs and, you know, cabaret and so on, and they just drink themselves stupid, whereas middle class people and wealthy people sit at the table with their wine and drink themselves stupid.
Sure.
But privately.
Yeah, fewer people see that, so it's a different thing. Wine.
Yeah, fall off the floor onto the table, it's fine.
They have a servant to drag them to bed.
Get rowdy in the street is something else, right? It's all about, so I think wine can, you know, wine sort of sustains propriety, and these other alcohols, sustain unruly behavior and asocial behavior. So I think all of these things sort of play into it, which gives wine a really privileged status.
Yeah, it gets coded as like a bourgeois and upper class beverage.
Correct.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
So the late 19th and early 20th centuries are bad for France in a lot of ways, right? Like, and you know, hosting a couple major world wars, having the ground, you know, basically exploded all around is one thing, but that's not the only reason that this is a really bad time for French wine. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the big problem is phylloxera, right? Phylloxera is a tiny aphid, tiny yellow aphid. It's native to North America, and it lives on vines, grapevines particularly. And so, you know, native grapevines in North America just had these aphids, and they just tolerated them. They could live with them. But in the 1860s, some of these North American vines were shipped, because this is before the ideas of quarantining and, you know, the transfer of diseases of various kinds. Some of these vines were shipped into Europe, mainly into France and England, because they wanted to plant American vines to see how they would do, because American vines had a reputation, or American grapes had a reputation of making bad wine. And they wanted to see what it was about these grapes that, you know, didn't really make good wine. Anyway, the aphids came with them. And then, you know, were planted in French vineyards, and then so moved on to the French vines. And the French vines had no experience of them, were intolerant, and so the aphids began to kill the vines. So you can see it starting around the Mediterranean region first in the 1860s, and then by the 1880s, all over France. So they lost probably about three quarters of the vines what died. And so there's a crisis, of course, because there was a shortage of wine. People started making wine from raisins and, you know, and all kinds of things. And so there's a problem not only of a shortage of wine, but also fraudulent wine, you know, widespread wine fraud. And everyone was involved in it. The Bordeaux people, you know, of these great chateaus, of course, were buying whatever they, you know, mixing anything they could because they needed to keep up the things. And that, so they lost reputation because people were buying the stuff and it didn't taste right. So it was a real crisis. Now they figured out how to deal with phylloxera by the 1880s. And so, you know, by the early 1900s, the vines were back. But the whole question of wine fraud and the reputation of French wine were just ongoing issues. And that's when you get the appellation system, of controlling grapes and production methods and that kind of thing. That's a response to wine fraud. It's designed to say, if you have a wine that satisfies the appellation rules, it's genuine wine, not...
So that happens in 1935, and it's a pretty serious turning point. And I feel like this creates the wine world I know, right? The AOCs. Can you explain those? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it started earlier. I mean, they began in the first decade of the 1900s, and then they again just after the First World War, but trying to put in place an appellation system, and so they were working towards it. And then, you know, in the mid 30s, as you say, they began. And you know, started with a few like Chateauneuf du Pape and a few others. And then, I mean, they're still creating appellations. I mean, they're still right from the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and so on, still creating more appellations. And some of the, you know, some of the well-known ones are quite recent. But this gives you some kind of certainty. And it was a system that was then adopted by the Italians and the Spanish and the Portuguese. So right through Europe, the wine producing countries adopted versions of the French system. And then in the New World, I mean, the New World systems weren't as limiting. I mean, in France, you can, if you want to make an appellation wine, it has to be made from these grapes or this grape. And, you know, in the New World, you can use any grape varieties you like. So it's a much more permissive system, but it really is the set the tone, I think, or set the set the conditions for more control over wine and for better quality wine. And so overall, you know, wines have been, it's hard to say. I mean, we don't know what these early wines tasted like, really. And also tastes change, right? I mean, you know, what we would discuss, what we would think was disgusting, they might have thought was delicious. But, you know, I think from the 30s, but then particularly from after the Second World War, you really start to get improvements in things. And then there's a big boost in the 1980s and 1990s when, I mean, Italian wines started to improve. I mean, I remember growing up with terrible Chianti
giant jugs.
You know, and so on. I mean, now Italian wine is so much. Italian wine is fabulous, but it wasn't. And the same with French wine, to be honest. And Chilean wine, Spanish wine. I mean, I grew up in New Zealand. New Zealand makes very good wine now, but I grew up, and I mean, when I grew up and started visiting wineries in the '60s, it was truly disgusting. I knew at the time it was disgusting. And so on. So, you know, things have changed, but the appellation systems, these controls on production and viticulture have been really, really important.
Well, but I mean, and you assert that the past 50 years have been a golden age of wine, which, yeah, of course, nobody wants the golden age to be what we're in, but it is. Why do you say that? Why do you think that?
Well, I just think because wine is a purer product. I mean, you know, I mean, people who talk about natural wine, it's a term I don't like. But natural wine will say no, but there are all these additives. You can add acid, you can add tannins, you can add this, you can add that. Yes, you can. But it's a fairly pure wine product. I think quality is good, and also, I mean, depending where you live, you can get wine from anywhere in the world, and you know, I mean, I go down. I live on the border of Ontario and Quebec, so we have two alcohol systems, and I can cross the border and buy wine, and then I can come back onto my side and buy wine, and I have probably one of the best selections of wine in the world here. And if you live in New York, and I mean, live in American cities, the same, and in London, and in the Netherlands,
yeah, in Amsterdam, right? Yeah, I can have wine delivered to my house from around the world overnight.
But go to France and you can't. I mean, you can buy French wine.
Yeah.
Go to Chile and you can't. There's Chilean wine, right? I mean, I was at a conference in Bordeaux a couple of years ago, and they suggested everyone should bring a bottle of wine to a reception. And I was giving a paper on Burgundy. So I thought, well, and I was coming from Canada. So I thought, well, I'll just buy a bottle of Burgundy while I'm there. So, ever tried to buy a bottle of Burgundy in Bordeaux?
No, I have not.
I went into store after store and said, "Do you have any Burgundy?" And they said, "No."
Like, Manon.
Question: Do you know where you are? And I finally found a little store, and I said, "Do you have any?" And the guy said, "No." And the wife, I think, said, "No, we have one bottle. Remember?" And she came out, very nice bottle. So I took that. But I mean, that's what it's like. I mean, God forbid you should be able to buy a bottle of Chilean wine or Californian wine in Bordeaux. So, so I think, I mean, it's not true everywhere, but you know, many parts of the world where we have open wine markets, we have like fabulous selection of wines. I can go to my local store and I can get wines from all over the world.
Oh, it's wonderful, and delicious wines. And I think, you know, a lot of people are drinking wine and there's a lot of talk about wine. There's a great market. It's a really good time for it. You know, as I finished this book and I cast around kind of in my mind for overarching statements I could make about the relationship between France and wine. And I have to say, I'm kind of at a loss, short of just, you know, your conclusion, really, you know, when you say that the history of wine and the history of France are inextricable. And that's really all I can, you know, there are no overarching trends. It's just that France and wine are just linked. And that's what I've got. So I would like to hear your comments. What am I missing?
No, I think it's true. I mean, it hasn't always been true. But I mean, you know, there's a point probably from, you know, probably from the Middle Ages, I think, you know, when they started the big Bordeaux trade with England and Northern Europe. That's when, you know, people began to think, well, you know, and they didn't even think of French wine. They thought of wine from Aquitaine or from Bordeaux. And from that point, and then Burgundy came on stream and then Champagne and so on. And then wine drinkers began to think of France when they thought of wine. And then the French began to think of themselves as represented by wine. And it's very important during the French Revolution, which I'm studying now. I mean, they think of wine as, you know, drinking wine together is like a revolutionary Eucharist, right? And then, you know, 100 years after, the parliament actually declares wine to be the national beverage of France. But it's been a very, you know, it's kind of complicated relationship, which is what you'd expect. You know, I mean, some regions do well, other regions have grievances because they're not doing well. It's a long time before the South gets recognized as producing anything other than just cheap bulk wine. I mean, the First World War is also important because, you know, wine becomes the fluid that the army runs on. A liter of wine a day as a ration. I mean, that's pretty serious stuff. So it's a complicated relationship, and that it hasn't always been happy, I think. Phylloxera was a terrible time. Right. And there have been, you know, wars and trade disputes and that kind of thing, but I think in the end, I mean, the French do identify with gastronomy and style, you know, and wine is part of this. You know, there's a kind of a veneer of luxury to the whole thing, even though the bulk of the wine that they export is ordinary everyday drinking wine that's not very expensive. You know, you still think of the sort of the high end from probably half a dozen regions. So it's it sounds like a bit anticlimactic, but you know, to say that, you know, there is this identification of France and wine, but there it is.
They go together. That's France is a Frenchman is smoking in a beret and they're drinking a glass of wine with their baguette. That is just
exactly that.
Yeah, that's how we have it. Yeah. All right. So in the world of the author, this book is quite a bit behind you, right? Because it goes, listeners, you have probably heard me talk about this before, but you know, a book, you send this book in a year before you see it on the shelf. So this has been between covers for a while. And you've mentioned several more projects. So what are you working on right now? What's the next thing we can read from you?
Well, it's a history of cats.
What?
It's a cultural history of cats.
All right. How did that happen? Oh, goodness. Listeners, he's reaching down, and I believe I'm about to meet a cat. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I am meeting the chubbiest, beautiful little cat. Beautiful, enormous cat.
Well, I got two of them. They're siblings. And I love cats. I always have loved cats. And sorry. and I've always thought, well, I'll write a history of cats when I retire. But this pandemic has been so disruptive to my work. I haven't been able to travel, right? And I have these books that I need to travel to finish. So I thought, well, I'll get going. I've been collecting stuff on cats. So it's nearly finished. I hope I'll finish it by the end of the summer. So it's a cultural history of cats from domestication, from the wild cats in the Middle East through to the present day. So that's
all right.
That's the next one, but it's completely off.
Yeah.
Off the thing. What I've got with a colleague in Burgundy, I found the records of a priest in the 18th century who was a priest for 50 years and who kept detailed records on the vines belonging to the parish. like weather records for the whole year, the production, what the grapes looked like, how many baskets of each they picked, how much wine they made, what they sold it for, and so on. So it's a 50-year record. So we've done a transcription of the register, and then a long introduction together, and that'll be published by Dijon University Press next year. They've got it right now, and then I'm working on. I'm just really starting the Wine and the French Revolution, and so that's a. I've got a sort of a 4-year research grant for that one, and then. The Wines of Southwest France, which is under contract for the Classic Wine Library. So those are what I'm doing. So I'm going to finish the cat book by the end of August, and then I start teaching again in September. But then I'll start traveling again. I hope it's then possible.
Yes, it will
and,
be.
I'll be able to get back to France and then work on this other stuff. So the cat book has been actually good. It's kept me busy. And but it's finite. It'll be finished and sort of out of the way, and then I'll have to find a new retirement project.
All right. Well, I'm guessing you won't have much trouble with that, just based on your Catholic interests. I think it'll be all right. Oh, thanks so much. This has been a great time.
Good. Yeah, I've enjoyed it. It's been a great way to spend the late morning on a nice day here. Yeah.
Excellent. Take care.
Okay. Thanks, Anna. Bye.
Bye.